This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Christian Parenti is an author and journalist. He has written for The Nation, The New York Times, and other publications. He is also a professor in the economics department at John Jay College at the City University of New York. Parenti will speak on Thursday at Western Michigan University. His address, called At the Precipice, The International Political Economy of Capitalist Crisis and Climate Change, begins at 7 o'clock in Knaus Hall. Christian Parenti, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Let's start with that title. It seems like there's a lot in there, At the Precipice. Are we at the precipice right now when it comes to climate change?
Well, we're approaching it. The science on climate change is unfortunately pretty clear. We've got about 14 major computer models that have been forecasting how climate change will unfold for over 30 years, and they've been more right than wrong. And, you know, they've been predicting an increase of drought, flooding, more intense storms, and all of that seems to be playing out. And so part of the problem with climate change is that the rate of change is forecast to accelerate. So it's not just a linear problem that, you know, gets incrementally worse, but that the worse it gets, the faster it will deteriorate, the faster the climate system will unravel. So we might be on the precipice of very, very serious environmental upheavals, which will no doubt have very profound economic and political ramifications. So that's the precipice that we're at. And, you know, global capitalism is facing significant crises with sort of stagnant growth for the last 10 years since the crisis. Regions like Greece really suffering with major unemployment. A lot, you know, the pigs, as they call the peripheral economies of Europe, still suffering quite a lot. And similarly, parts of Latin America have really slipped into recession, like Brazil. So the macroeconomic outlook is not so great either. And then there's also the political calculation. And there really does seem to be a kind of a breakdown, a failure of the traditional leadership class. I think you saw that in Hillary Clinton's campaign, and we see it in the Trump administration. And this is nothing like previous presidencies, which, you know, whether you like them or dislike them, had a kind of managerial capacity and sophistication that this one lacks, or that the Clinton campaign certainly lacked. So, you know, and this can be seen also in Europe, the way that the Northern European states dealt with the Greek crisis. It doesn't seem they necessarily had a plan, and they're just prepared to let Greece and other peripheral economies suffer very, very badly with no real plan on how to deal with this, how to deal with the refugee crisis that's flowing out of the Middle East. U.S. foreign policy is in many ways very responsible for that refugee crisis, the invasion of Iraq, the total failure to rebuild that economy, the fact that Iraq remains essentially a failed state, that our foreign policy has helped push state failure in Libya and in half of Syria. And this strikes me as a real profound, just at like a technical level, a profound failure of political leadership to confront the economic, social, environmental, military crises of the current moment.
Are a stagnant economy, which you mentioned, and a climate crisis related? Do those two things feed off of each other in some way?
Well, they're related. I don't think that a stagnant economy feeds off of climate change, but they're related in the fact that part of why economic growth hasn't been more robust. I mean, this last quarter was 3%, but the quarter before that was Wang was with 1.5%. You know, we have not broken 3% growth for a year in a, you know, for a consistent four quarters in a long time. Even China, which was, you know, rip roaring at 10% for 20 years, is down to like 7%. But they're linked in that actually, you know, what American capitalism needs is a new round of creative destruction and investment. So part of what the boom of the 1950s, late 40s, 50s, 60s, into the 70s, that golden era of American capitalism, and really it was kind of a golden era for Europe as well. A lot of that was predicated on the fact that World War II had destroyed enormous amounts of capital stock. And the process of rebuilding all of those industrial cities from Tokyo to, you know, to Dresden, that involved, you know, long period of growth in which there was high rates of growth, very high taxes, rising wages, but also high rates of profit and reinvestment. And then late 60s, it becomes clear that there's some overaccumulation is setting in, glut is setting in the global economy. There's too much capacity. The world economy can produce more cars, more automobiles than can be absorbed. By 1970, 99% of Americans have, you know, most of the consumer get like refrigerators, and like 64% have air conditioners, and you know, the demand just isn't sufficient to meet the potential output. And that has been a problem that remains, and that's part of what has driven deindustrialization in places like the Midwest. With this overcapacity came sagging profits, and then in the quest for raising profits, business goes in seeking cheaper labor abroad, but that then, of course, undercuts demand at home. So what the economy really needs is for the fossil fuel industry to be written off, wiped out, and replaced by a new clean energy infrastructure. And if that were to happen, if government policy were bold enough to drive that program forward, it would lead to a revived long wave of growth and accumulation. Now, that might have deleterious environmental effects, but it would help us deal with the climate crisis by mitigating the problem of fossil fuel caused CO2 emissions. So they're linked in that actually, you know, the solution to a stagnant economy relies in the solution to dealing with the climate crisis.
So how does the government go about actually doing that? As you say, wipe the fossil fuel industry off the map and pave the way for alternative energy, given that, you know, the United States has, by and large, kind of adhered to a free market system of economics.
Yeah, well, see, that is a huge myth. That is not actually the real political economy of the U.S. Going back to Hamilton all the way through, the U.S. capitalism has developed as a mixed economy with considerable government protection, government subsidy, and implicit government planning. And, you know, we subsidize the fossil fuel industry in any number of ways. One of the most obvious ways is that just over 25% of fossil fuels come from public land. So the government would do it by reversing the system of subsidies. Step one would be no more drilling for oil, no more mining coal on public land. Step two, remove all subsidies like production tax credits to the fossil fuel industry. Increase subsidies for the renewable energy sector. And the government has also driven the economy historically by being a consumer of technology. For example, the first generation consumer of aerospace technology was the government. Computers, similarly. Unfortunately, through the phenomena of war, many medical innovations have also been driven by government, you know, not just R&D, but also consumption as a consumer. So the government should be switching its own fleet of vehicles and its own buildings to renewable energy, and it should be retrofitting its buildings. So the government can cut subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, increase subsidies to clean tech, and start consuming clean tech. If it did that, it would start sending cues to the private sector, which has enormous amounts of money, and the private sector could build out this infrastructure of clean energy, et cetera. The other thing that all economists agree on is that the most important thing to do to get off of fossil fuels is have a carbon tax. Tax carbon energy and the products that are made from carbon energy. We actually have the legislation already on the books to impose a de facto carbon tax. It's the Clean Air Act that was amended by a lawsuit called Massachusetts versus EPA in 2007. And that lawsuit held that the federal government has to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. We've been waiting since then for now 10 years for the government to issue a series of tailoring rules that would set limits on the amount of fossil fuel carbon dioxide pollution that industry could emit. Industries would be free to burn coal and pollute the atmosphere, but they would have to pay heavy-duty fines if they did that. That would act as a de facto carbon tax. It would mean that the cost of dirty energy would rise. As the cost of dirty energy rose, more investment would flow into building out clean energy capacity, vehicles that use clean energy, and the price of clean energy and of clean technology would drop commensurately. So we have the capacity to impose a de facto carbon tax without passing the legislation, and that would be very important to do, and that would really help push the transition. And that's, these are all kind of old-fashioned methods. This is, in fact, how the railroads were built. This is how the land-grant colleges were created. I mean, the iPhone has 12 different forms of government-subsidized created technology in it that were developed in the name of military preparedness and then licensed to the private sector. So, everywhere hidden in our lives are the result of government, hidden government subsidy and planning, choices made by government about how capitalism will develop. So step one is to not be in denial about the fact that government does play a big role and always has in the direction of the economy.
I have read some things where you have used the term shadow socialism. Is that what you're referring to here?
That's what I'm referring to. Yeah, that's one way you could put it. It's a kind of like, it's like the Brits talk about the party that's not in power has shadow government. It's a kind of socialism, loosely defined, that is hidden in plain sight, that we're in total denial of. And when people ask, how can we make this transition to clean energy, which is really a project of clean industrialization, it's a project of reindustrializing on a different energy basis. I say, well, we should look first at how we originally industrialized. And if you do that, you see that there's this kind of shadow socialism, massive subsidies in the form of public land to the canal companies, to the rail companies, to the airline industries before their airlines, the buying up of patents by the government and making them free early aeronautics industry. Again and again and again, there are these forms of subsidy that we just don't talk about. And if we did talk about them and thought about them, we could probably come up with a better version of this kind of crypto planning and drive our economy in the direction that we need to go.
Do you think that there is more reluctance on the part of government officials to use that power when it comes to the energy sector, especially given some of the political change of last year with President Trump being elected?
Absolutely, yes. One of the major problems is that the political class lives in fear of the fossil fuel industry, and the fossil fuel industry has been very aggressive in defending its interests. Our Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, comes from ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil has been found to have spent millions of dollars supporting climate denial, the promulgation of fake science that denies the reality of climate change, when we now know that Exxon's own science since the late 70s has been clear on the fact that climate change is real. The Koch brothers have led a group of powerful billionaires, investors who have given enormously to promoting climate denialism as well as a kind of fanatical free market mythology. And some of the Koch-supported groups have gone after even moderate Republicans who dare to stand up to them on the question of climate change and fossil fuels. So, yes, the political class is afraid of running afoul of this most powerful industry in world history, which spends on changing people's opinion, on messaging, on the intellectual infrastructure, funding endowed chairs in economics, and on political campaigns, trying to support those who will carry water for the fossil fuel industry and punish those who dare speak out against it.
So how do you think political pressure could be generated that would lead things in another direction and might create actual movement on climate change?
Well, there is a climate movement. It's just not, as big as we'd like it to be. So it requires people organizing and pressuring government at the local level and at the state level. I mean, there's going to be very little happening at the federal level under Trump, it seems, but there are still very large state economies like California and New York where there could be significant experiments in, for example, like switching state vehicle fleets from gasoline to electric. And I think that, you know, possibly as the storms, the extreme weather associated with climate change hammers urban infrastructure in the United States, we might see a new constituency of people in this storm zone developing, demanding assistance in the rebuilding of their cities. And this, I think, will bring forward, put front and center the class questions of who's going to pay for this? Who's going to pay for maintaining, rebuilding the coastal urban infrastructure, that part of society, which really everyone depends on, these ports and airports and universities, et cetera? Is it going to fall to the majority of working people in these regions, or is the 1%, which has more money than the 1% has had in a very, very long time in this country, are they going to be forced to pay higher taxes and pick up a larger portion of the bill of rebuilding, of preparing for climate change, if necessary, retreating from the coast, building bioshields, building seawalls to defend cities? So I think in those zones where they tend to be coastal zones, where extreme weather is going to start hitting hard and already is, as in Puerto Rico, as in Houston, we might see a new kind of constituency developing that doesn't recognize itself as a movement around climate change per se, but what they're really going to be struggling around is the question of adaptation to climate change and what form of adaptation is just, who will pay for our society's inevitable efforts to adapt to climate change.
You wrote a book back in 2011 called Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. And one of the things you argue in there is that the effects of climate change are more than just severe weather, that in some areas of the world it has led to war and led to famine and other things. You know, in the United States, are we still fairly insulated from that? Is it still the case for us that what we're going to see are, you know, hurricanes and those sort of things, which may be awful, but still in poorer parts of the world, it's still going to be, the effects of climate change are still going to be worse?
Yes, in the short term, in the immediate term, the effects of climate change are definitely going to be worse in the global south. But what I was arguing in Tropic of Chaos is that climate change is already helping to fuel violence by interacting with free market economic restructuring that weakens governments so that they can't respond to extreme weather, and also by interacting with the legacy of Cold War militarism and the war on terror, which has littered much of the global south with weaponry. So that's where you see this sort of extreme combination of all these factors leading to climate violence. But in the north, to the extent that there's a growing xenophobia and state hardening, partly in reaction to waves of migration, this is particularly true in Europe, right? There you could say, well, there's a kind of northern, global north version of a climate violence developing. You see this in the form of Frontex, the European border patrol agency, building up its forces in the Mediterranean, and also in the rise of far-right xenophobic anti-immigrant parties in Europe, such as Alternative for Germany, which in the last German elections got about 13% of the votes. So there's also a kind of, you know, coercive hardening of the state and drift right of politics in many northern countries. And we've seen that in the U.S. along the border with the rise of kind of xenophobic politics that has, for example, in Arizona, the law of a couple of years ago, SB 1070, that made it mandatory for police, local police, to check immigration papers of people who they might have suspected of being undocumented. Similar laws have gone through in other states. It's actually to the point now where there's a severe labor shortage setting in the fields of Arizona, California, Alabama, in terms of agriculture.
Are we getting close to the point where climate change events may encourage people to take action, or may get people to say, wow, I guess we really do need to do something about climate change, but is there the risk that it's going to come too late and that there will already be serious long-term impacts of climate change, even in wealthier places like the United States, which are irreversible?
Yes, well, we're definitely locked in for more changes, because there's a serious delay between cause and effect, right? The pollution that goes into the atmosphere and the greenhouse gas pollution that helps trap heat coming in from the sun, it takes a while for the effects of that to play out as extreme weather. So even if we stop burning all fossil fuels tomorrow, we would still be in for decades of change, decades of warming, decades of rising seas, and decades of increased disruption to the climate system in the form of increased drought punctuated by flooding. So we are locked in for considerable disruption. Are we at the point of no, beyond the point of no return? No, I don't think that's the case. I think that it is possible to prevent the worst of climate change. The great fear is that climate change can become self-perpetuating. If natural systems break down, they can become the primary causes of greenhouse gas emissions. For example, the boreal forests of Canada and Siberia. Currently, they are carbon sinks. They absorb more CO2 than they emit. If due to global warming, they die and burn and rot, they will become net emitters. And once we cross enough of those tipping points, then the problem of greenhouse gas accumulation is out of our control. Right now, the primary cause of greenhouse gas pollution is human civilization's burning of fossil fuels. So that's the bad news, but that's also the good news. We can still control it. And we have the technology, we have the money, and we even have the laws on the books, as I was talking about earlier in terms of the Clean Air Act and how it was changed by mass the EPA. We have what we need technically and economically to start dealing with this. So it's important not to collapse into cynicism, because that is a luxury we don't have.
Christian Parente is a professor in the economics department at John Jay College at City University of New York. He's also a journalist and author. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me on.
Christian Parente will speak on Thursday at Western Michigan University. His address, At the Precipice, The International Political Economy of Capitalist Crisis and Climate Change, begins at 7 o'clock in Knaus Hall. Links with more information can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.